Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren. And on today's episode, I'm very happy to welcome Sheila Flanagan, the co-owner and CEO of Nettle Meadow Farm, a cheese producer based in the southern Adirondacks of New York. Known for their original cheeses such as Kunik and Flavor Fromage Frais, Sheila and her team have won over 60 international and national awards for their cheese and dairy products. Sheila, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's fun to be here.
Yeah. It's great to have you on. You're one of my favorite New York producers. I'm based in New York, so I'm a big fan of Nettle Meadow and Kunik. And actually, I'm really stoked to ask you this first question because I think it's one of those things where you've been around for a really long time. And so I'm going to throw it right to you right now, which is, Sheila, Nettle Meadow is one of the few very iconic creameries in the U.S. with cheeses distributed in most cheese shops across the country. You know, a lot of people, I don't think they know you as well as, say, Matteo Killer, David Gremmel, Sue Connolly, or Peggy Smith, you know, the classic cheesemaker crowd. Why do you think that is? Why do you think you've been, like, kind of in the background for a little bit compared to those other cheesemakers?
That's a good question. A few people have asked me that over the years, and I attribute a lot of that to my personality. Those guys are, you know, I've had the pleasure to work with some of them, and they're outgoing and they're fun. And I think I chose, and I'm fun. I'm not saying I'm not fun, but I am definitely an introvert. And I think I chose making cheese over standing in a courtroom about 20 years ago because I was picturing, you know, being up on a mountainside. Just myself, my partner, and some animals, you know, quietly making cheese, listening to books on tape and podcasts, right? And it took me an entire decade to realize that I needed to go out in the world and see what kind of other cheeses were being made and to kind of try to ingratiate myself with the world of cheese and introduce some of the wonderful cheeses we make to other people. So I've had to come out of my shell, and it did take me a long time, and I'm still working on it, still finding more and more ways to go out there and chat with folks and, you know, do something like this, which is totally against my personality, which is, you know, a podcast that lots and lots of people are going to hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're so glad that you're brave enough to come on the show today, that you are putting yourself out there and showcasing Nettle Meadow more and more now. I think it's really, it's time. And I'm just so glad you're taking that step. Another fun fact that I learned about you from the people I know out there in the cheese world is that you're not just a cheesemaker, actually. Like, you're really going above and beyond outside the cheese community. Do you mind telling us a little bit about the other things that you do out in the world that are, you know, for civil service and that really highlight the person that you are? Because it's really kind of amazing what you do.
Sure. So I came to cheesemaking as a second career. My first career was as a pretty much a trial attorney in complicated medical cases. And so I have a huge, pretty significant legal background. And so I still use that part of my head plus the agricultural and the cheesemaking side of my head. So not only am I a cheesemaker, but I teach classes on cheesemaking at the Adirondack Folk School. I'm one of the board members at the Adirondack Folk School, which is one of our largest folk schools in the United States. We can have a whole nother podcast on that someday. I also am the Farm Service Agency director for this county, Warren County, which is a very interesting and dynamic agricultural county, because we do a lot of maple syrup as well as, you know, your common dairy type agriculture. And I have served as a judge for something crazy like going on 12 or 13 years because of that legal background in our local community. I also just joined the American Cheese Society's board last year because I am obviously just love to, you know, find ways to use up those last hours of the day. So, I do a little bit of everything. I think it's fun to, you know, to kind of make myself kind of spread those different areas of my brain to all of these different parts of our community up here in Warren County. And they may sound like a huge jumble, but they really are closely connected, because Farm Service Agency is very close to agriculture. The Folk School is all about teaching cheesemaking and historical artisanal cheesemaking in particular. The American Cheese Society obviously is all about my passion in cheese. And then being a judge is just keeping my toe in that little part of my brain that's still in law and litigation.
Yeah, I mean, you're like one of the busiest people I know. I think I've heard from other people in the industry, like, Sheila doesn't sleep. She's up all the time. She's working all the time. She's taking care of everything. Like,
yeah,
it's very impressive that you're able to keep everything going all the time. So now I think it's best that we reel it back into Nettle Meadow, which is, like, I guess your cheese baby, I want to call it. Mm-hmm. But can you tell us a little bit about how it got started and your journey to get Nettle Meadow going?
Right. So that does, I mean, it goes back, and hopefully the last time in this interview that I talk about law or legal, but it goes back to, over 20 years ago when I was still very young, but was already realizing that law probably wasn't filling my soul with anything positive. And both my partner, Lorraine, and I really wanted to kind of turn the corner and do something more fulfilling. I come from a long family of Irish dairy farmers that, you know, I always romanticized the fact that, you know, they did things with their hands and produced things with their hands. And, which seemed like a much better long-term lifestyle than pushing papers and standing up in a courtroom.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's definitely more romantic to be making cheese, right?
Well, and until you start doing it. And so Lorraine and I had these adorable little Nigerian dwarf goats, which was like truly a pet project for us in Oakland, California. We made cheese with this tiny herd of Nigerian dwarf goats. And it really was. It was great cheese. We made, you know, basic stuff, chevs, a few bloomy rinds, and it was so good. And it was, you know, almost as good, maybe sometimes better than cheeses that we would get at our fantastic neighborhood cheese shop in Oakland, California. And, you know, we were like, wow, we should really do this, not realizing that the butterfat content in Nigerian dwarf goat cheese is incredible, but economically nobody can actually do that because you can't really maintain a herd of, 3,000 Nigerian dwarves, which is what you'd have to do.
it's a serious statement said out loud.
So that's where we started. And honest to God, I was sitting in a really boring phone deposition one day, and I was trying to keep myself awake, checking out different farms for sale around the country. And I saw the Nettle Meadow property and I forwarded it to Lorraine and I said, this is the one. We've got to do this. Let's go check it out. Let's take a vacation. And we did. And we had rose colored glasses for sure. I mean, the place was in really bad shape and the goats were ready to retire. Some of the barns were falling down. There had been a really nice dairy barn that had just been built, a hoop barn, but everything else really needed a tremendous amount of work. The owners that had owned it before us, a wonderful couple who had developed and kind of who had developed some goat cheeses and sold them very locally. They had put all of their money and time and effort into cheese. There was less electricity than a modern lawyer might expect, and maybe, less insulation. But, we toughed it out and started with 36 goats. I think we retired 30 or 32 of them the first year, kept four in the herd, bought a bunch of goats from two or three other cheesemakers in the area who were retiring and doing other things, and quickly grew. I mean, grew fast from 36 to 4 to 120 to 250.
Wow.
So that was the beginnings of, we drove across the country in a couple of Honda Elements with Nigerian dwarf goats, crossing cats in the back. So you can imagine how amusing we were at every rest stop when we'd open up back and give everyone water. People thought we were pretty crazy back then, and they probably still do.
No, but we're so lucky that you did this and that you've taken the chance. And, cause it's not just goats. Well, was it only goats that you raised on your farm? Was there cows and sheep as well?
Yeah. Yeah. So I do have to put a shout out, to Dave Gimbalvo from, the old Cheeseworks, crew. He was the madman that convinced me. We're both from the same hometown, Stamford, Connecticut. He visited the farm one day when we were strictly goats and a few happy Jersey cows. Mm. And we really needed to buy a bunch of sheep as well to make life totally unmanageable. And so that we could be one of the very few three milk farmstead cheese companies in America. And I think when we started, it was 2006 by then, I think we might have been the only or one of two three milk farmstead cheese companies in America. So we had a little bit of everything back then. We had the goat herd. We had about 22 very nice East Frisian sheep that we raised from lambs from the old Chatham sheep herd. Really fantastic herd of sheep. We still have some of those original sheep are still alive and kicking in the sanctuary right now. And then we had about 8 Jersey cows. So that's really how we started. And we went from making chevs, our goat's milk Crane Mountain, and obviously the Kunik, which is, our best known, our iconic cheese, the cheese that people started to notice and, write articles about, put in books of the top 50 or top 100 cheeses of the world. That's where things really started out. And then from there, we branched out into things like Three Sisters, which is one of the three milk cheeses we make. And yeah, we just got crazier and kept making more and more different types of cheeses from there. We did it all in a tiny kitchen-sized cheese plant. At the time, we had a really good-sized aging room, but the cheese plant was so small, and we ended up doing work on four different stories. So basement, wow, plants, and then two stories above that. So I was younger and I was definitely more fit at that point, because we ran stairs all day long. In the beginning, we just worked with a few people. We had, after the first year, we hired a herd manager, a couple of farm hands, because the herd was growing and growing, and a few cheese plant assistants. Eventually we just ran out of shoulder space. We were just bumping into each other constantly. And so, but in the beginning it was definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like it. It sounds like you really put your body to the test.
Yes.
And your mind. So I guess my follow-up question to this is, you know, you've been a cheesemaker for 20 years and you must have a passion for it. What is it you love most about cheesemaking?
So I think I'd have to say it's a two-part answer. I love to create something that others will enjoy all around the country. So when we make a cheese, we pour it into a mold, we wrap it up, put it into a case with others, we don't know if somebody's going to eat that in Oakland, California, or Stamford, Connecticut, Miami, Florida, Seattle, Houston, Texas, but we just hope that it brings joy to that person or that family or that couple or that puppy dog. I've heard from people that say, you know, your cheese is my cat or my dog's favorite, whatever it is. So that's one of the things that I really enjoy is that sense of making and building something with your hands, sending it out into the world and having it be enjoyed. And then the other part of that I really do love, especially as I get older, is sharing that creativity and passion for cheese making with a young team of people who, you know, share that passion for artisan cheese making in America, quality cheese making. We are not... we are not craft cheese. We are trying to make, you know, our goal is to be recognized every year, if possible, as making some of the best cheese in the world. And, you know, the young people on the staff, the middle-aged people like me on the staff, you know, are really pumped about the opportunity to come in and do that each and every day. So, I just think that it's that joy of spreading that and creating a great team to bring that into the future is the other half of what really makes me get up every morning.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well said. I want to go back to the source of these things. Besides your excellence in cheesemaking, I believe that you have a keen sense for milk, like the quality of milk. And, so you were a farmstead. I want to talk about how you were a farmstead production until 2020, right? Like you were doing all the milking on your farm.
That's correct. In all honesty, we had farmstead animals until 2020, but a third of them we had already leased out in late 2018, early 2019 as kind of a pilot project to see how that would work. We had leased them out to three families, two sets of goats and a set of sheep. And again, it was only about a third of our herd overall, to see how that would work, if the quality would stay up. We visited them every day to make sure that they looked like they were getting what they needed. Were they happy? Testing the comparison of cheese made by milk coming in from those three farms versus the milk that was being made on our own farm. So this is kind of a very slow moving, plodding evaluation to see if it was possible. Because part of what we dealt with all along as we grew was that the problem of having a limited number of staff that you could really find and get excited about what we're doing, which is making fantastic milk and fantastic cheese. And so as we continued to grow and needed more milk sources, we decided that this might be the best option for us. Goats and sheep that had actually been raised on our farm, goats that had been handpicked for the value of, you know, somatic cell counts over years, butterfat combinations. So we didn't want to buy from an all alpine goat farm, which is lovely high production, but not as much butterfat for cheese. And we didn't, you know, we didn't necessarily, but so we wanted to work with goats much like we had been producing for almost 15 years at that point, which was a very strange combination of alpine Saanen, which is the high production, and then La Mancha and Nubian, which are the high butterfat. And then the fifth goat that was all intermixed in our herds and still is the boar goat. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, people laugh at us and say, well, that's a meat goat, Sheila, if you didn't know. Hmm. And I always say yes, but the wonderful thing about boar goats is that they're just so resilient. They're so hardy. And, you know, here we are, two crazy girls trying to make cheese in an area that gets so cold and so hot. And that is, you know, our vets are an hour away at best. If something terrible happens. And so you want some hardy girls with a little bit of meat on them, strong bone structure that are able to withstand those sorts of climate variations. And so that's the mixture that we worked on for 15 to 18, almost 18 years at that point. And they were just really great producers, long producers, and really great goat milk. And the same thing with the sheep milk from the East Frisians. I just can't say enough about those girls. They were so healthy. Some of them, we had one sheep named Penny who would milk literally 365 days a year if we let her. And she produced almost a gallon a day, and that's just an unheard of in sheep. We were extremely lucky, still are extremely lucky, because we still have the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh, probably 12th generation of some of those East Frisians still producing milk for our cheeses now. So,
wow. I mean, it's incredible, Sheila, that like you're doing all this. Again, I want to remind the listeners in upstate New York, the Southern Adirondacks, like it's really incredible that you were able to be so resourceful with these animals and you self-taught yourself all this. Am I wrong to say that? I mean,
much of it was self-taught. And, you know, one of the things I like to say, though, I mean, All of the true animal husbandry was taught. When we bought the farm, like I said, we bought it from a very nice couple who'd been making a small amount of cheese, had some great ideas, had some great flavors that they were already working on, and had some great cheeses that they were already making. But, you know, we worked with them for maybe 3 weeks when we got here, and animal husbandry for a very quickly growing group of goats and sheep. That was a lot of learning and a lot of tears year in and year out after oftentimes learning the hard way. You know, I have been the assistant surgeon on more goat C-sections than I'd like to remember. I've birthed more baby animals at 2 o'clock in the morning at, you know, 20 degrees below zero than I'd like to think about. Especially
Wow.
Especially as I I'm approaching, you know, those upper years now. I'm so glad that I did it all. I'm so glad that I'm not doing it now. I don't know that it would have been sustainable. I always remind people that Lorraine is a decade older than me, and she certainly would say it is, would not have been sustainable to still be doing it now. So I'm grateful for the experiences, but it's hard work, creating, helping to breed healthy animals, with that are illness free, that are, you know, producing holistic natural milk. One thing we never did is we never certified as organic. I know that's not one of your questions, but in terms of quality of milk, but we did and we still do insist on only natural grains and natural hay, without fertilizers and other things that can make animals sick and, you know, can affect milk quality as well.
Yeah, but that's responsible. And it's a good, and I think one of the outstanding factors of Nettle Meadow is that really high quality milk to make such a good cheese. And I think that's what, when I talk to other people in the cheese industry or even cheese enthusiasts, they can name Kunick really fast as one of their favorite cheeses. And so actually lining into my next question, I really want to talk about Kunick and, like, you know, it's one of the most iconic American cheeses. Actually, it's a basic kind of question, kind of funny. But what does Kunick mean? I know the word is a word. It's a word, but I have no idea what it means. What does it mean, Sheila, to the name Kunick?
So Kunick is a word, and I'm going to delve into something that, you know, people don't always ask me about in interviews, and I don't know that I've given as much credit is due. Kunick is a word that comes from one of the original goats on the farm. She was a great big Saanen goat. She was a very sassy and full of personality kind of goat. You know, the world was all about her. And the farm that we inherited, they started making cheese in 1992. So Kunick was actually on the farm before Lorraine and I were on the farm. Oh. So I think it's important that people realize that word, that term, and that goat even precedes Lorraine and I. And the concepts, well, you know, so the concepts behind Kunick, a lot of those pieces are things that I must and I have to attribute to Lori Goodhart, who was a little fledgling cheese shop girl at Fromaggio Kitchen in Boston. I can't tell you exactly when. She is a good friend of mine, but I'd say she probably did this stint probably when Fromaggio Kitchen in Boston was starting out in the late 80s.
Wow, big shout out for them. That's awesome.
And yeah. And she was in love with French Bloomy Rind cheeses. And she thought the double cremes were great. And she thought the goat cheeses were great. And she wanted to do something in America like that. And her and her husband, Ronald Hebert, had started to create a cheese like that. They were selling it in upstate New York when they wanted to sell Nettle Meadow. Part of what they wanted to sell was that concept of Kunick that they were working on. And I, you know, the first wheel that I got from them, I loved. But over time, you know, Kunick was kind of a gooier creature than it is now, and also a much stronger flavored creature than it is now. And people, you know, I'm talking like this is a folklore thing, but people like to say that my development of Kunick is, you know, in keeping with Lori's ideals. And I know that Lori still loves the Kunick and they still buy it from us. But I will say that it is what I have created here, because I am kind of the Kunick maker, is a cheese that is very, I wanted to make sure that it spoke to the clean flavors that were important to Lorraine and I, so that mm-hmm. there wasn't that super strength of flavor that you sometimes get in farmstead cheeses that are, you know, maybe kept at a higher temperature, or maybe they have to sit around a few days longer so that you have enough milk to make a whole batch of cheese. So we wanted to focus on really clean flavors with all of our cheeses, including Kunik. And I also wanted Kunik's structure to be dependable no matter what month of the year it was being made. And no matter whether you were a cheese shop buyer in San Francisco at Mission Cheese back in the day, or whether you were getting your cheese at Murray's in New York City. So those were my goals, and that's what I wanted to do with Kunik, because it, you know, it really fluctuated. And there's a beauty in the regionality of cheeses that, you know, go up and down from soft to hard, depending on the season, and flavor changes depending on the season. But that's a really hard sell to an American public. And it was always our goal to not just be tiny, but to sell to distributors and sell around the country if possible. And maybe that's because we were girls that had lived on both coasts. You know, a large part of what I did is kind of take this blooming creature that Lori had dreamed about and made it something that was something that people all around America could start recognizing, asking for, and that was dependable, that a shop on the West Coast or the Midwest knew that they could buy that cheese no matter whether it was January or August.
Yeah. And I would say also, like, back in my day when I was selling it at a counter, you know, whole half or quarter size back then, it was an American triple creme standout. Mm-hmm. I think that's what also put it kind of made a difference. Am I wrong about that? Did you get that feeling that was also, I mean, besides all those amazing points you just made?
Yes. That's really taking, you know, cheese making and buttery cheese to, you know, the highest pinnacle in my mind of where you can go. And, you know, triple creme cheese making is really difficult. And there's a lot of cheese that ended up going to the neighbor's pigs because you put too much culture. You know, you need to put enough culture in to keep its balance and enough rennet in to, you know, maintain its sense of body, but you put in too much culture and, you know, you think you're just eating a goat cheese, and you put in too much rennet and it tastes awful. And so, it was, you know, a constant, you know, there's no question that in the first 5-6 years, I was always, honing our craft and trying to explore ways to make Kunik as dependable as possible in the state that it was. And, you know, even simple little things like the rind, making sure that the rind was always what the people would anticipate. You know, there's only so much you can do as a cheese ages over a 3 or 4 month period. And I spent tons of time at food shows, you know, educating people about how cheese is a living creature and it has its own life cycle and it changes every day. But I also, you know, I feel for the cheese monger who's trying to sell that cheese and trying to find those things about Kunik or whatever cheese that are always the same that they use. You know, like I always tell people, it's a buttery brie with a goat kick. Mm. I also tell them it's got, you know, kind of a mushroomy element to it. And that comes from the terroir of our caves. But all of those things always have to be there. And it's got to be moist enough to be so enjoyable that you want to run down to the store and buy another piece. But it also has to be dry enough that I know that it's not going to collapse into a puddle by the time it reaches San Diego. I remember shipping 150 pounds of cheese to the Artisan Cheese Center in New York City almost 20 years ago now. And they called me up and said, you know, Sheila, it's soup. And a lot of that had to do with the day and the amount of ice. And I never shipped it to them ever again. I always drove it down there, which is, you know, exhausting, but important. But you know, that those are the elements, and the Triple Crown element, I think, makes it one of those iconic, special, a little bit magical cheeses. But it's making a cheese with that level of butterfat is also, you know, tough to do.
Yeah, no. I give you a lot of props for being like the master of balance in cheese making, like understanding the milk, understanding the cheese recipe, like really thinking of all those details is, it's really amazing. So actually, you know, with all that being said, because I really just love what you said about Koenig, I want to take a quick break. Hey, everyone, you're listening to Cutting the Curd. I'm here with Sheila Flanagan of Nettle Meadow, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Kara Warren, and I'm here with Sheila Flanagan of Nettle Meadow. We are deconstructing Koenig. We are learning about upstate New York and about Sheila's origin story, because we never told it before on Cutting the Curd, and we're stoked to have her here, and it's really just the best to have her here. So now I want to take a deep dive back into the cheese, and I'm looking at Adirondack, which is a newer cheese from you, Sheila, and is it getting popular? It seems to be getting very popular.
It is. It's kind of crazy because it's a cheese that we developed, 4 or 5 months before, you know, COVID started. And so I was really fearful for this poor little cheese that it was, you know, going to die a quiet death because so hard to market, so hard to get the word out. There were no food shows to get people excited about it. But it's really caught on in popularity. People buy it all over the country now. It is a special cheese. It's got this great little tangy flavor to it that I have not tasted in any other cheese. And I, you know, like I said, I hide on the mountain. I try not to come down all that often, but I've gotten a lot better because I know that, and I'm out a lot more. People will see me at food shows and, you know, at stores and different places, because that, you know, making sure we get our name out is so important because we do make great cheese and, you know, people should try it. But getting back to Adirondack, I think that apple brandy is something that we add it to every batch, and then we actually add it when we're pasteurizing the milk. So it's infused.
Oh, wow.
It's infused in the cheese. And so the brandy is there through the entire aging process. And so it gives it a really fun and unusual tang. It also takes a triple creme cheese, which Adirondack is. It's an all Jersey cow triple creme. But it makes it almost like another level of creamy because the tannins or the acids in that brandy then break down the butterfat even further. So, you know, I am all about personal challenges. I think that it's always, you know, it's a good growth process. And so, you know, Kunik was hard to get it, you know, stabilized and get it to be very dependable, always the same kind of cheese. But then we add brandy and really fatty Jersey cow milk only to that whole process. So it was definitely a learning process. I think that Adirondack is now in a beautiful place. It ages incredibly. I just did a show for one of our bigger distributors and, you know, trying to get myself out there and not hide under the table. And mm-hmm. when we got there, I realized that the Adirondack was, you know, it was a little, you know, it was about 65 days old. It was on the older side of things. My team loves to spring little things like that on me at shows and see if I'll spring back and find a solution. And I took out some wooden spoons and, you know, I'm the cheesemaker and I'm supposed to be, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't even know what the right word for it is, but you know, I try this cheese every day. And so it shouldn't knock my socks off, but it is so amazing when it's that age and when it's that gooey and when you can just spoon it out. It the flavor, the butter, the whole thing, it was just super great. So as soon as I got back from the show, I ran downstairs, looked for a really old piece of Adirondack. And then I pulled all my managers together and I said, you've got to try this way. And they all just about fainted on the floor. So they now have a new favorite cheese at a favorite date. It was wonderful. It really is.
Oh, goodness. Okay. I'm excited to try it at that stage. I have to find a piece with you and check it out. And then like, so you have those two cheeses, but how many cheeses do you have total in your portfolio?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say how many cheeses we have in our portfolio. So we have right now, truthfully, honestly, we have over 50 cheeses in our portfolio.
Wow. That's a little crazy, Sheila.
It is. It's more than a little crazy if we're going to be
honest. You're a mad scientist, some might say.
We are. I think that is all too true, the mad scientist piece. And, you know, we've all talked about it on our team and we've said, you know, this just, it's as we're growing, because we've moved into a new facility. It's a much bigger facility and we're producing a lot more cheese. And because quality is really one of our most important tenets, we all agree, our entire team, that we really have to cut it back. And, we've been playing with this and I've already heard tears from so many people. Oh, Nettle Peaks is my favorite cheese. Oh, Briar Summit is my favorite cheese, but we really have to cut it back. And even to me, you know, 12 to 14 cheeses still sounds a little nutty, but you know, it's a lot easier to manage when you're trying to work with higher volume. So I think that we're getting to a point where we're focusing ourselves on the best of the best, and then also on what our customers have shown us that they enjoy and they're buying the most, because you know there's just so many cheeses that we make and you know we sell, but it takes away from Kunik. It takes away from Adirondack. Takes away from, you know, some of the others that are that. So anyways, 50, but reducing.
Yeah, but that's great. You'll have your all-star cheeses shine a little brighter that way. And it'll be easier for people, I think, to discern, you know, those great cheeses that you're making, like the Adirondack and Kunik, like you said. I'm excited to see what happens next going forward with that idea.
Yeah.
But also, so I want to talk next now, because we're talking mostly about cheese, You also do a really incredible line of fromage frais. Mm-hmm. I see it everywhere. And I would love for you to explain to our listeners what a fromage frais is, because I think it's its own, you know, type of dairy product. So.
Right, right. So, and you know, the thing about it is that I think that the term fromage frais came a little bit out of that culture of ours living up on a hill. Like, fromage frais is different for different people. Mm. So part of our fromage frais is, well, what did we mean by that when we created it? And basically it's a fresh cheese, right? It's a fresh cheese in a cup. And we had a few types of Chèvre, which is the traditional all goat's milk cheese. But we wanted to, there was a really nice article about me in some New York magazine. It wasn't the New Yorker. It was like New York Times Weekend or something. Mm-hmm. I remember it was the same weekend they had an article about one of the Baldwin brothers. So it was... I don't think it was the New Yorker, but anyways, they called me the queen of mixed milks. And I thought, well, that's very nice. That is a very nice compliment. And that is exactly what we talk about when we talk about fromage frais, because fromage frais is a mixing of goat's milk and cow's milk. We mix it together. We pasteurize it together. We take it out. We drain it. And then... we mix it with some amazing, when possible, local, otherwise just very high quality flavors. We come up with some great cheeses. So some of our most popular mixed milk cheeses right now is the fig and honey. The fig mm-hmm. is certainly not local, but is very high quality. The honey is local and also very high quality. We also make a blueberry lemon, which is a lovely cheese, especially in the springtime. And the blueberry lemon, it kind of, both of those kind of harken back to our original fresh cheese that Lorraine and I started making, which is the honey lavender fromage blanc, which is a little bit different character. That's for the people that just love a goat's milk cheese. And I love showing honey lavender at food shows or parties or really anywhere, cheese tastings, because it shows the clean flavors of nettle meadow milk better than I think any cheese we make. Because if you've got an all goat's milk cheese and you're just putting a little bit of honey and something so delicate as lavender in it, if there are some unsettling, shall we say, barnyard flavors in that milk or that cheese, you're going to taste it. Anybody's going to taste it. A smoker's going to taste it. You know, somebody who just had a really hot, you know, Indian meal is going to taste it. You're going to notice. And so that is why. And similarly, the fig and honey and the blueberry lemon, you're taking the goat's milk, you're mixing it with cow milk. So not only do you get that super clean goat's milk flavor of the honey lavender, but now you're adding in that super high butter fat Jersey cow milk. And so it's just over the top. I can't tell you how many times people will like try one of our fromage frais for the first time and they'll say, oh my God, this is like eating cheesecake out of a cup. And you know,
I mean, it's so addictive, the honey lavender. Like I, you know, I first thought, okay, crazy lavender. I'm not sure I'll love that. Mm-hmm. But then I tried it and I was like, this is so good. And again, so balanced. It's really the trademark of your, you know, of your products is the balance in them is amazing. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, I'm just like thinking about it. But I do want to take a look now at something more current to Nettle Meadow, because it's one of the reasons why we really got together for this interview is it's something that I think quite a few cheesemakers go through, which is, you know, you're doing so well, you're kind of starting to outgrow your cheesemaking room, mm-hmm. You know. When did you have that aha moment that you wanted to like scale up for production? Because, and if you can explain to the listeners what you've done during the pandemic years of all the times to do it,
sure.
you know, so like, when did that start to, for you to scale up production and maybe tell your story of what you're doing now to help increase production?
Well, in 2015, we really started thinking about, we've got to build out, we've got to grow more, because the demand was really increasing, and we'd gotten to a point where we had about 15 to 18 people working in this really small cheese plant place at any one time, you know, at our farm in Thurman. And it was like, this is, you know, this is crazy. We're banging into each other. It's inefficient. We've got to grow. And so we looked at, you know, we tried to do it methodically. We tried to be smart about it. We thought, you know, should we grow on this space, or, you know, at the farm in Thurman, or should we move ourselves not too far, but somewhere? Like, there was no three-phase power I'm sure a lot of your listeners are saying, three-phase power, what is that? Because everyone has it, except for if you're, you know, up on a mountain in the middle of the Adirondacks. But there was no three-phase power for larger equipment in Thurman. There's no, how should I say nicely? There's like, the septic system is your own personal septic system when you're out there. Right. And so, you know, sure, cheese and fatty whey is the best way to destroy your septic system over and over and over again. And, you know, we did not really have anywhere to expand that septic system. And we had to, in order to grow on that location. And, you know, we'd already done crazy things to grow. We had bought a farm a mile and a half from the original farm to grow all the baby goats and baby sheep and some of the calves, so that they would not be exposed to any illnesses or diseases on the main farm. And then we bought another little farm up the road so that we could house more farm workers. And we were like, you know, this just is doing all this in the same location. It's kind of like, you know, banging our head against the wall. So we looked at some locations nearby, not too far away. We're very close to the Lake George region in upstate New York. So there are some, you know, cool larger buildings. It's also close to Queensbury and Glens Falls. So we looked at some, you know, larger brick factory-like spots. We looked at some really big restaurants that we could refashion to turn into some, you know, into a cheese plant, maybe put an addition on them, all closer to three-phase electricity, more employees that might be interested in working with artisan cheese, closer to more urban septic systems with more space to develop a septic system. So one of a friend of mine from Lake George had shown me a couple of properties, and he said, you know, Sheila, you got to look at this hitching post place. It's, you know, it's an amazing historical structure. It's 18,000 square feet. Nobody's done anything with it for like 15 years. It's so big. You could have your offices, your cheese plant. You could, you know, have a restaurant there if you want to. And I looked at a video of it, and I said, there is no way in heck, we'll leave it clean, no way in heck that I am going to spend the money it would cost me to heat that place in the wintertime. It's just, you know, I'm crazy, but I'm not that crazy. But as I thought about it, you know, that 18,000 square feet for our cheese plant would be amazing. And that's kind of what we needed, because we, you know, the worst thing you want to do is grow for just tomorrow or 2 years from now. You want to grow, you want to do something that you're going to be able to build into that over the next couple of decades. And so we loved the Hitching Post location because it's on 9N, which is one of the main thoroughfares in the North Country. So it would bring more people our way.
But also, I just want to point out, it looks like an old log cabin. Like, it's this incredible, yes, like, old building structure that like really captures the eye when you're on the road there. And it's like, it's so cool that you fashioned it into a cheesemaking plant now.
Yes. It's a structure that means so much to the people of this town of Lake Luzerne. Like the Hitching Post was the place. It was this amazing, I mean, the huge pieces of logs that were put into this building. And I can't tell you how many people tell me that their parents or their sister or their grandparents were married here, or they met their sweetheart here. I mean, like everybody's life has like gone through this building, and it just sat dormant. I think when he told me 15 years, I think it was more like 20 or 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And when we decided to buy it, one of the dormers actually collapsed 3 days before the sale. And I had to decide, did I want to take that on too, or were we going to back out? And we just decided to go forward. And I'm so glad that we did, because so many of the people that we have found in this area that are working with our team now are people that are not just passionate about our cheese, but are passionate about the history of this building and of what it means to the community. And we've gotten so much goodwill from the community up here because they recognize that we're insane for trying to rehabilitate this building. But we've finally gotten to a point where it is rehabilitated, where we have this amazing capacity to make so much more cheese than we are now. Plus, we have this beautiful restaurant where we focus on cheese boards and some cheese related menu items. Really nice, really great local woman chef, and then a really nice high end cheese shop where we sell our cheese and some other upstate New York and Vermont cheeses. It's a fun location. People love it here. Once they come here, they come back over and over and over and over again. It's a beautiful space, and that's one of the things I'm really proud of is, you know, the great cheeses we make, but also being able to bring this building back.
Yeah, no, it's super amazing. I'm excited for others, once they listen to the show, hopefully to get up there and visit at the Hitching Post. It's super cool. And now I kind of want to turn it around to the, like, with this expansion, you have you have more challenges now, which is, you know, money, cash flow, and things like that. At least we've talked about this on the side. You know, can you elaborate on, like, you know, what has life been like since this expansion?
Absolutely. Yes. So, I mean, the expansion is really exciting. The new team members that we've brought in from the expansion is really exciting. But yeah, there is a huge downside. And the downside is, you know, the cash flow side. We have the capacity now to produce all this cheese, but now we have to sell that cheese so that we can pay the bills to, you know, pay for all the renovations that were made to this amazing building. And to pay for all of the upkeep on it day in and day out. So we're really, I mean, that's truly in addition to, the everyday stresses and challenges of bringing in the right people and quality people and making sure that the milk supply is perfect. And that the cheese is going out in a quality way that represents, the true heart of Nettle Meadow. Now we have this extra layer, which has been on us all 20 years, because there's always a financial stress layer in agriculture. But this is like financial stress on steroids, because...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So with that remark, actually, what do you think the listeners can do to help support Nettle Meadow going through this transition?
Well, I think, you know, the best thing that you can do for us is, if you're a distributor, buy our cheese. If you're a cheesemonger, buy our cheese and tell the story of our cheese and our company and our animals and our people. If you're a shopper, buy our cheese, share it with your friends. If you're looking for something to do, we're only 3 hours away if you're in the New York City area, or if you're in the Boston area, closer to 4 hours, but it's totally worth it. Come visit us. Have a fantastic cheese board with some local beer and wine. Come talk to us about cheese. There's also, if you go to our website, you can make a donation to our sanctuary, which is a 501c3. If you're familiar with our cheese, share the story of our cheese with your friends. You know, bring our cheese to your next party and tell people about our cheese. I mean, I think that, you know, our tagline, which I've been using for well over a decade now, is a culture of caring from the herd to the curd. It's such a critical piece of what we're doing, because you start out with super care for these animals, and that goes to really fantastic milk quality, which goes to really fantastic cheese quality. And we've got this great team that I feel so fortunate to have, especially in our modern society, to have these people that are still so motivated by the concepts of artisan quality, unusual, unique, iconic cheeses. And then, you know, getting that out to the public in the best shape that we possibly can. I mean, my crew is wrapping and loading a truck with cheese on Sunday nights. This is a 7 day a week type of operation, just so that we can get the most kind of the best cheese and the best condition out to locations all over the country every week. So please look for our cheese, look for Kunik, look for Adirondack, any of our cups, our three sisters, buy cheese.
Yeah, no, I think it's super that we get the industry on board and cheese shoppers out there to support Nettle Metal right now, because we want you to be around in the next 5 years. And I think, you know, it's just super important to have your cheeses in the market. So,
and we have talented young people here that can keep this cheese in the market for, you know, 30, 40 years. We just have to get over the hump of the financial, stress that it takes, and actually the financial muscle, I think we should focus on the positive that it takes to, expand like this into something as unique as the Hitching Post with its, you know, I've always thought it should be a Taste of New York building, because it's beautiful. People can come, they can watch us making cheese. Yeah. It's just a fabulous location, but it is expensive. So buy cheese.
Yeah, definitely. I think the cheese industry at least knows this kind of story a little too well. But I just want to say, Sheila, thanks for coming on the show today. This was amazing. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. It was great.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I'm just going to tell the listeners real quick where they can find you. So hang on there. So please follow Nettle Meadow on Instagram at Nettle Meadow Farm. Plus, you can follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren. And please listen, subscribe to Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks. And eat more Nettle Meadow cheese.
Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.